From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. French President Emmanuel Macron said today that he has proof that it was the Syrian government that attacked the town of Douma with what he described as chemical weapons. He did not give the source for that proof. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons is looking for proof. Its team should be on the ground in Douma this weekend to investigate. Syria and Russia both deny it was a chemical attack at all. Nick Patton-Walsh is CNN's senior international correspondent. He's in northern Syria and is on the cell phone. Nick, tell us first, is Syria bracing for some kind of military strike?
Yes, obviously. After the extensive telegraphing, U.S. Commander-in-Chief President Donald Trump on Twitter, it is clear that there have been movements of the Syrian military who are on high alert, and activists suggesting, in fact, they've relocated various assets around. Now, that presents two problems. One, that the obvious places you would choose to strike historic military bases, things like that, may be empty. And two, also, they may now find it difficult at a U.S. military level to clearly enough distinguish between Russian assets and Syrian assets, which leads you to really be concerned when you hear about the unleashing of firepower imminently, that that could potentially be like chucking a match into a powder keg.
That even pinpointed firepower will not necessarily work, you're saying. There are many parties who are worried that the United States will shoot first and ask questions later. So let me ask a question now. Is there hard evidence that the Syrian government was behind this chemical attack on its people in Douma?
If you mean by hard evidence, is there a sample from eastern Ghouta, Douma, where the attack took place at the weekend that appears to be in the hands of Western countries? I would believe the simplest and fairest answer is probably no, because that area was held by rebels under siege and then is now held by the regime. So the speed of delivery of 5 days and the testing, it would be remarkable were it possible, potentially. A sample being tested is the ultimate standard of hard evidence, but the circumstantial evidence is pretty clear for many to see, given who were the victims, Syrian rebels and the civilians in their midst, given the area that was attacked and given the history of the Syrian regime of using chemical weapons. But what kind of substance is important? Because sarin gas was used in October 2013 and caused the Barack Obama famous red line to be crossed, but no military action followed. And instead, Russia persuaded Syria to go along with a program of giving up its chemical weapons, clearly not all of them. Sarin was again used in April of last year, and that resulted in Donald Trump having a very emotional reaction to the pictures he saw of children suffocating to death, and he launched 59 Tomahawk missiles. What's not clear now is exactly what the substance was. Now, aid workers at the scene report smelling chlorine. That's a household chemical widely available, but very toxic and deadly. But UNWHO observers report seeing within those people who were affected muscular spasms in the quite troubling videos. Now, that would suggest, experts say, some kind of nerve agent. And other experts say, too, look, you don't get 40-plus dead people and 500 affected from chlorine. It's simply not powerful enough, which leads to the potentially worrying development of maybe this was chlorine mixed with some kind of nerve agent. That is potentially what Emmanuel Macron is pointing towards with his statement about chemical weapons. But it does appear that there is a broad body of evidence or suspicion amongst many Western nations that sarin may have been involved, or a more powerful or similarly powerful nerve agent. That's why I think we're seeing this level of international cohesion.
You know, international actors don't always act logically, and that includes Syria's president. What reason, though, if we assume he's acting logically, would he have, what motivation would he have to launch some kind of chemical attack, especially given the fact that his forces have just taken over Douma, have already taken over Douma completely, and apparently could have done so even before this attack. So what would be his motivation?
Well, you're asking me to look at the rational actions of a man who's waged war against his own people very, very brutally. And many observers have suggested that, in fact, these chemical weapons are often used at key points in sieges or at key points when territory is in dispute to spark fear. There are some who argue that in April of 2017, the Khan Shaykhun incident was, in fact, used to test Donald Trump to see whether the new occupant of the White House really was gun-shy or whether he would honor the stepping over the red line that Barack Obama, his predecessor, had set. It was clear that he did have an emotional reaction and he did respond with firepower very quickly after the incident actually happened. But you have to look at Bashar al-Assad now as a man who's been a bunker mentality now for years. Only, I think, two trips out of the country, both to Russia, his latter sponsor. And so this is not necessarily a man whose perspective is clear, as it might be from the outside, or one really who's shown the slightest regard for innocent civilian life in the past 6 years.
All right. Thank you very much. Nick Patton-Walsh, CNN senior international correspondent, speaking with us from northern Syria. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you so much, guys, for having me. Bye.
This week, when Senator Tammy Duckworth became the first senator to have a baby while in office, that was understandably the headline. But many women also took in that she's a double amputee, was a combat veteran in Iraq, and that she is 50. It prompted the question, what is the latest thinking about age and giving birth? Let's get some answers. Dr. Jessica Shepherd is an OBGYN at Baylor University Medical Center in Dallas. Dr. Shepherd, we know the risk for complications in pregnancies increases every couple of years, but what is the ideal age?
You know, we've done research on age, obviously with fertility and the optimal time to be pregnant. Now, we know that in your later 20s and into your early 30s are typically the most physiologic times to be pregnant. But also when we talk about fertility and age, we look at the ability to be fertile and how much your eggs and ovaries decline over the years. So that optimal age is usually from your mid-20s into your very early 30s.
Yeah, they say 25 to 29, so pretty much that ballpark. And what are the other issues? Because fertility is one thing. You want to be sure that you can get pregnant. But what are the complications once you do as you get older?
As a range from all body organ systems, including cardiovascular, pulmonary system, and just the kind of beating that a body may take during pregnancy, it really does affect all organ systems. And so the older that a woman gets outside of being able to conceive spontaneously, we also look at the risk of increase in miscarriage, increase in preterm delivery, increase, and also cardiovascular issues, which might lead to preeclampsia, which can affect the pregnancy and also mom and baby.
But women are waiting. According to the government records, the National Vital Statistics, for women 30 through 44, birth rates are the highest they've been since the baby boom era, women waiting later. And then you have in 2017, Janet Jackson giving birth at 50, and Senator Tammy Duckworth more recently. What are you thinking as you're watching those wonderful successes, those blessings for them at 50?
You know, I think it's very encouraging for women who do decide to wait for fertility and, you know, for childbearing. The one thing that we want, you know, women to understand is that the spontaneity of pregnancy does decrease significantly after the age of 35. So that doesn't mean that you cannot get pregnant after the age of 35, but the ability to do that spontaneously significantly declines. So we do know that for women after specifically the age of 40, the chance of conceiving every month is about 5%. When in your early 30s and 20s, that's roughly about 20%.
Right.
So the real message out there is that we want women to know as they get a little bit older that sometimes they may need a little bit of assistance, whether that's with a little bit of infertility, in vitro fertilization, any help that may increase their chances of getting pregnancy, but also optimally their health before getting pregnant. So decreasing obesity, increasing your nutrition, and those things will also help women who are older conceiving spontaneously as well, aside from help.
But you mentioned in vitro fertilization. This is extracting their eggs, combining them with sperm in a lab dish, and then the fertilized eggs, the embryo implanted in the woman's uterus. It's expensive, on average about $12,000, $12,500 each. But we're also reading there are odds there as well. For those under 35, the success rate, more than 40%. Above age 42, it falls to about 10% per cycle at $12,500 per cycle. From 40% to 10%, that's a big drop.
And that's an important statistic that you bring up and is very important for women to understand as well. So, again, even in vitro fertilization after a certain age really does, again, decrease your chances of having that assistance with pregnancy. So that's why we like to insert the conversation or the information rather than education for women who are younger to consider freezing their eggs at an earlier age if they do decide to push back on fertility and childbearing experiences for later on in life.
We're seeing pitfalls there. The companies that hold on to those frozen eggs have fallen far short in a couple of recent cases, and the eggs were destroyed. And then there are still the questions. Okay, the eggs might be viable, but your body may not be.
Absolutely. And that's why we encourage making sure that you're at optimal health, making sure that you decrease your chances of having diabetes and hypertension. We also like to have the discussion with women to consider a donor egg. And so in a donor egg consideration, again, there's not necessarily a freezing process, but also having now eggs from a younger female, which may be easier for women to get pregnant and carry that pregnancy as well.
Do you think Tammy Duckworth, also a double amputee, severe combat wounds serving in the Iraq War, Janet Jackson, 50-year-old mothers, giving birth at 50, do you think there are outliers or going to become the norm?
I do think that we will see a slight incline in pregnancies after the age of 40. But again, we need to look at the numbers and see if these are, again, spontaneous pregnancies or assisted pregnancies with either IVF or even donor eggs.
Dr. Jessica Shepherd, an OBGYN at Baylor University Medical Center there in Dallas. Dr. Shepherd, thank you.
Thank you.
We've been hearing a lot this week about the political and economic implications of the growing U.S. federal deficit. A new report from the Congressional Budget Office concludes the deficit will top $1 trillion in the next 2 years. That takes into account the Republicans' $1.5 trillion tax cut signed last year and a $1.3 trillion bipartisan spending bill signed last month. Republicans often blame the deficits on entitlements, and one group of economists thinks that that is dishonest. The economists, writing in the Washington Post, say entitlements don't deserve all the blame. They say large tax cuts and unfunded wars have been big contributors to the deficit. Martin Bailey co-wrote the piece, and it was the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Clinton. He is now senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's in Washington now. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
When we talk about this term, entitlement programs, we're talking about Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security. These are extraordinarily expensive programs. Wouldn't reducing spending on them help bring the deficit down?
Yes, it certainly would. And we need to work hard to try and find ways to at least slow the growth of these programs. Social Security is not as hard as maybe it looks. We could make that 75-year solvent with some fairly modest increases in revenues and maybe some adjustments on the benefits side. Medicare and Medicaid are more difficult because health care is so expensive in the United States and generally has been growing price has been growing extremely rapidly. Now, actually, the cost per enrollee in Medicare has grown only very slowly in the last 3 years or so, 15, 16, and 17, only around 2% a year. So it's actually been pretty good. Some of that's coming from the things that were done in the Affordable Care Act. So things have been done to try to slow the growth of those programs, and cost per enrollee are not going up very fast. On the other hand, we have an aging population, and lots of people are turning 65. They're collecting Social Security. They're joining Medicare. Medicaid pays for nursing homes for people who don't have any money, and so there are more people going into nursing homes. So even if we do the best reforms we can, unless we make real draconian cuts, the costs of those programs are going to continue to go up.
What aside from draconian cuts could be made that would make a difference?
Well, as I mentioned, health care is so expensive in the United States, and Medicare, I think, is not a very well-managed program. My colleague Alice Rivlin here at Brookings has made a number of suggestions. Other people have made suggestions. And so I think there are ways we could maybe have more managed care in Medicare. What I would not like to see is where you sort of put old people out on their own and say, you go find your own health insurance and maybe we'll give you a bit of a subsidy, but it'll go down over time and you're going to be up a creek. I don't think we want to do that for our old people.
Well, Republicans say, as we're looking for cuts and trying to help curb the deficit, that tax cuts will help do just that, bring down the deficit, because they'll spur the economy. The Congressional Budget Office said, indeed, tax cuts will expand the economy by about 0.7% over 10 years. Do you think that's enough to make up for the cost of the tax cuts?
No, it's not nearly enough. The tax cuts that was just passed last year, and by the way, don't forget we had big tax cuts earlier in this century, so we came in with big deficits, and then we had the Great Recession, which didn't exactly help our debt and deficit situation. So we're facing an aging population, the need to provide these programs, and so more tax cuts is just, I think it's insanity, and I'm really surprised that responsible people are saying, oh yeah, we can solve this problem with tax cuts. That's just not right.
When we look, though, at specific cuts to reduce the deficit, what would you recommend? Military beyond entitlements? Where would you look?
I'm not an expert on the military. I mean, I think we have a very fine military. Whether we need to raise defense spending in the way that it's being raised, I think one should take a hard look at defense. But by the way, there's some things that we're not doing that maybe we should be doing. We're not maybe doing enough on infrastructure. I don't think we're spending enough on research and development. It's not just a matter of cutting things. It's also a matter of investing in things that are going to improve our economic future.
I want to ask you a bigger picture question here, and that is, what is the problem with spending more money than you have, more money than you bring in? I mean, we know for personal budgets, it's not a good idea. Is it different on a national level?
There are times when it's a good idea to have deficit spending. When we had the Great Recession, it was the right thing to do to spend some money to try to increase aggregate demand and get the economy back towards full employment. And that, you know, it didn't work fantastically, but it worked well. We did turn the economy around. So during recessions is a good time when you may want to spend more or cut taxes to get back to full employment. But over the long run, I think we, at the very least, need to make sure that our debt to GDP ratio is not just rising out of control. And that's what it's doing at the moment. And that's what it's projected to do by the CBO. And others. So if the debt is going from 70%, which is already high, to 100% of GDP, which is really at the level we had right at the end of World War II, then I think this is, we're taking away our options. We're making servicing the debt becomes more expensive. So a lot of tax revenue goes to just pay interest instead of providing services. So maybe we don't get a crisis. We could get this could bring on a financial crisis. I think the bigger danger is simply that we're passing on this burden to future generations, and that's not fair. We need to, on the long run, in a reasonable way, pay for the expenditures that Americans decide they want to make with their government.
Martin Bailey was chair of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Clinton. He's now a senior fellow at Brookings. Nice to speak with you.
Thank you.
We have a story now about the coyotes that inhabit large swaths of the American Southeast. There are millions across the region. It's not clear how coyotes have become so good at adapting to the presence of humans and how we can learn to live with coyotes. A new study by scientists at the University of Georgia offers some answers. Grant Blankenship from Georgia Public Broadcasting explains.
3 years ago, biologist Michael Chamberlain and his colleagues from the University of Georgia's Warnell School of Forestry were out in a field near Augusta fitting a female coyote with a GPS collar. She was one of the animals they would follow for 2 years across hunks of Georgia, South Carolina, and Alabama, the largest southern coyote study to date. And back then, there were some things Chamberlain already knew.
Well, for one thing, coyotes in the southeast are relying more heavily on deer as prey than western coyotes do.
Deer hunters wanted to know more about that. As far as anyone knew, coyotes took fawns in the spring and scavenged deer during hunting season, but they didn't hunt. Well, the coyotes in this study showed Chamberlain something new.
White-tailed deer were the most important prey resource for resident coyotes.
These coyotes were hunting deer all year long, not just fawns in the spring.
The constant, consistent use of adults throughout the year is something you can't just ascribe away to scavenging.
Probably not the news Georgia hunters wanted to hear. But no love lost. They already kill about 40,000 coyotes a year. But the population is stable, maybe even growing. To understand why, here's Michael Chamberlain with the other key finding of the study.
What we've ended up figuring out is there really are two types of coyotes.
There are residents and transients. There are perhaps 250,000 resident coyotes in Georgia. Think about nuclear families on plots of land about 10 square miles that typically have farmland and hedgerows and maybe some forest. In the deep, wet woods is where you see the big shift to deer hunting. Otherwise, it's animals like rabbits. Residents avoid people.
Imagine a puzzle with pieces that don't fit tightly together. And the puzzle pieces are these resident territories. And then there are these transient animals, which are somewhat nomadic. They don't maintain space.
Transients are young animals, just leaving home, or perhaps formerly resident animals who've lost their mate. There's something like 90,000 of them in Georgia. Transients move in the space between the puzzle pieces, through power line cuts, highways, and cities, very human places, 60, 70, sometimes 100 miles at a time. And so when a resident coyote dies, a transient coyote hops into their puzzle piece and settles down. This knack for biding time in human places until someplace wilder opens up is what has allowed the coyote spread. It makes coyote management feel like whack-a-mole.
It does. At the property level, it does.
That's Charlie Kilmaster, the lead deer biologist for the Georgia Department of Natural Resources. He says you have to think bigger, like statewide bigger, hence Georgia's open season on coyotes. But ironically,
indiscriminate coyote harvest, it is not really that effective for improving things for wildlife.
Chris Mowry is an associate professor of biology at Berry College in Georgia and a founder of the Atlanta Coyote Project. He asks, given that killing coyotes on site doesn't dent their numbers and it doesn't help wildlife, why kill coyotes at all?
We just sort of feel like lethal management is futile. There are other alternatives.
Which brings us to Michael Chamberlain's next research project, to try to understand whether humans can alter the landscape in a way that steers coyotes away from deer and toward other prey species. Will it work? Michael Chamberlain says coyotes already thrive in environments we made.
In many respects, a lot of what we do as society plays into the hand of this animal.
For Here and Now, I'm Grant Blankenship in Macon, Georgia.
And there's growing pressure in Missouri for Republican Governor Eric Greitens to step down after the release of a special investigative committee report yesterday with disturbing details of an extramarital affair Greitens had before he took office. The rising star in the GOP, a Rhodes Scholar and former Navy SEAL officer, was indicted in February by a grand jury on a felony invasion of privacy charge. He allegedly took a semi-nude photo of the woman without her consent to keep her from talking about the affair. He's now set for a trial in May, but there's a bipartisan push for his resignation. And the Republican Speaker of the House, Todd Richardson, says he may call a special session to begin impeachment proceedings. Brian Ellison is host and contributor at KCUR in Kansas City. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Robin.
So the details in this report are disturbing, but basically this woman told investigators that Greitens was abusive to her, that there's binding, hitting, threats. Let's just leave it at that. He says the relationship was consensual. This is a witch hunt, like the one in Washington, he says. But lawmakers seem to believe her.
Yeah, this has been an interesting intertwining of the narrative here in Missouri with what's going on in Washington. Mm-hmm. As you said, the trial is not scheduled until May 14th. And from the beginning, since this indictment came up in February, the governor has made strong denials. And in fact, there has been a pretty solid effort to activate his message through his campaign, through favorable stories on Fox News, noting that there still wasn't any evidence that the photograph at the center of this allegation, and a photograph taken without the woman's consent and then somehow transmitted, that there is no evidence of that photograph. But as it turns out, the report that came out of the legislature yesterday suggests that maybe that photograph isn't the governor's biggest problem.
Oh, because tell us more about what that report said. Pretty salacious, so.
It was pretty salacious, and this is where it's a good time to warn listeners that there's some pretty graphic content. The report alleges that not only was the governor conducting an affair, which he and the woman have both said was a consensual affair, but there were a number of encounters within that affair that were not necessarily consensual. And perhaps the one that is most salacious, it is the one where the photograph was allegedly taken. It is said that at the end of that encounter, the woman was preparing to leave the governor's, or then Eric Greitens' basement, he grabbed her in a bear hug, laid her gently on the floor where she was sobbing uncontrollably, saying she didn't want this, and yet proceeded to unzip his pants, and they ended up having a sexual encounter.
Yeah, and so she said she didn't want that. Look, this is salacious. People are calling for impeachment. What are the chances you might see that?
Well, it seems more likely now than it did before, to be honest. A lot of Democrats and Republicans, in fact, maybe primarily Republicans, have been calling on the governor to resign for the good of the state. But yesterday, the Speaker of the House, a Republican, Todd Richardson, said that the committee that had done this investigating would now be newly empowered to make recommendations for discipline. And that could mean a reprimand or censure. It could mean articles of impeachment being filed against the governor. He also noted that they probably cannot accomplish that before the regular end of the session, which is in mid-May, probably before the governor's trial is even over. And so they were preparing to call a special session to consider acts of discipline against the governor.
And again, this is a very Republican legislature making these calls, bipartisan calls. Brian Ellison, host and contributor at KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri, that city reeling with this news. Brian, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has faced 10 hours of questioning on Capitol Hill over the past 2 days. The testimony was primarily about the issue of user data and privacy. Privacy has long been a fundamental tenet of American life. We have asked Nathan Connolly and Brian Ballow to tell us how. They are historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Welcome back to you both. And first off, Brian, let's start off with you, pointing out that despite the glaring light on Facebook, there are a lot of threats to privacy out there, online and off. So what draws your attention?
Well, I think virtually all the big digital companies are into the business of sharing data. What comes to my mind is a story about a father walking into a big box store, and he was really livid. He said, "Why are you sending these coupons to my daughter about baby clothes and cribs and diapers? She's just in high school." And the manager was taken aback. He apologized, and he called the father a few days later to follow up and apologize again. And the father said, "I think I owe you an apology. It turns out that my daughter's pregnant."
So it's hard to imagine what it was like way back when and how our privacy rights became ingrained in the Bill of Rights and this idea of protecting people as private citizens, as individuals. How, Nathan, did it rise to that level? Where was it recognized as and when was it recognized as a right at all?
Well, if you think back to the colonial household, right, it was much harder to, say, hide a pregnancy from one's father if you didn't even have separate bedrooms, right? So the colonial period was one of very intimate family quarters. You know, our modern notions of privacy almost didn't really apply to this period. But in terms of the country's political and social landscape, there were a lot of things that were happening in terms of relationships between the people living in North America and the British Crown, for instance. And so very basic things at the time, people being concerned about, say, one's mail being open. That was an issue of legislation. You actually had to have an act passed in 1710 to issue some kind of punishment for folks who were entering other people's mail. But as you move closer to the late 18th and early 19th century, you know, there's going to be a very acute sense that privacy is really an American value. And it kind of begins around the French and Indian War. You know, the British are trying to find ways to fund the effort. And they issue a series of pronouncements, which are supposed to allow British officials to go and look for tax items in people's homes, and unlawful search and seizure becomes part of the colonial anger in the late 18th century, you have the issues of violations of privacy, the Stamp Act, the Quartering Act, all these things that made everyday life something that was increasingly surveilled, helped to fan the flames of the revolution. So by the time you get to an independent U.S. in the late 18th century, privacy is really baked into the Constitution in things like the First Amendment, which really does protect our kind of private expressions. You have the Third Amendment, protecting our homes from the quartering of soldiers, the Fourth Amendment, which gives people the right to, again, be free of illegal search and seizures. And even now, as we have a lot of debates about the Second Amendment, we tend to go back and read it with an eye toward privacy, as if, you know, we were really concerned about individual right to bear arms, when in fact, we know it was really about the right of having a well-regulated militia, you know, state to state. But make no mistake, even with these various pronouncements and the Fourth Amendment or Third or First, it was still very difficult to ensure complete privacy. Even Thomas Jefferson, as late as 1801, basically decided he was going to stop putting political things in letters because his mail was being opened all the time and basically put into the opposing press. So even after the great founding document of the country, privacy was still a hard thing to come by.
So as technology developed, it's easy to forget how monumental and frightening things like photography was when that first came about. Tell us about that.
Yeah. I mean, even worse than photography itself was photography that could quickly be mass circulated through newspapers. And that's, in my opinion, when Americans really begin to get concerned about the kind of right to privacy that we think about today. And it came out of exposing people's peccadilloes, their sexual affairs, their romantic liaisons, and especially American elites, the kind who wrote articles in the Harvard Law Review, began to say, no, we have an absolute right to not be intruded upon by the press. And yeah, it was technology, it was photography, it was the telegraph, it was the constant bombardment to scrutiny, not by the government in this case, but by the press, that really led to the first assertions legally of an absolute right to individual privacy, to not be bothered.
Nathan, how did the issue of privacy intersect with the execution of a war, especially the Second World War?
So if you think about the need to surveil enemy combatants who might infiltrate the United States, you know, you can see that there are a variety of ways that this becomes an issue. Obviously, one of the most, unsavory chapters in American history is the episode of Japanese internment, right? Executive Order 9066, where you see, you know, internment camps of between 110, 120 Japanese Americans in 1942.
This is across the United States you're talking about.
Right, across the United States, effectively pulling Japanese Americans, again, citizens, off the street in order to keep a closer eye on them, right? And another major project in this period in August of 1945 was called Project Shamrock, and people began to collect telegraphic data entering and exiting the United States. It was a major project that ultimately gave birth to what would be the NSA, but it gave people, you know, access to telegraphs. And again, this is another moment where the technology of communication is seen as a point of concern. So the idea of being able to aggregate, surveil, to confine American citizens, that became a critical piece of expanding surveillance efforts and violations of privacy in the war period.
It was only 3 years ago that the U.S. Army officially stopped putting Social Security numbers on a soldier's dog tag. But Brian, I know the idea of a Social Security dog tag is not restricted to the military.
No, hardly. Perhaps the most popular government program over the last decades of the 20th century is Social Security. But when Social Security was started in 1935, especially those opposed to it said the government's going to assign you these dog tags. It's just like these authoritarian governments in the Soviet Union and in Nazi Germany. And the Social Security Board itself had actually planned to issue these metal identifiers, and they backed off from that. But there's a really interesting twist that Sarah Igo, a historian at Vanderbilt, tells. It turns out that a lot of Americans, once Social Security was started, they were proud of their Social Security number. There were lots of commercial businesses that manufactured those metal plates, and people paid full retail for them. My favorite story that kind of shows just how much people really identified with their Social Security number is the man who, when asked for his number, would just remove the upper plate of his dentures. and hand it to people. Perhaps they didn't touch it, but right there on that denture plate was engraved his Social Security number.
And it wasn't that long ago that when we would cash a check, we'd have to put our Social Security number right on the check for anybody to see.
That's absolutely right. We tend to get inured to what are initially seen as invasions of privacy. And I think that takes us right back to the Facebook story. We voluntarily give up a lot of this information for the sake of convenience. I'm not saying that Facebook shouldn't be more careful with our data, but I think most Americans understand that there are trade-offs involved between convenience and privacy.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. I mean, I think there's a way in which we need to have a certain amount of transparency to show up, say, in a credit report or to show up as belonging to certain kinds of institutions. People need to be able to Google us and locate us in ways that matter. And we oftentimes rely on not so much the government, but on corporations to now protect our identities in ways that is really unprecedented.
When you say not so much the government, even though it might be perpetrating some of the breaches, is the government at all staying ahead of this concern through history and now, or following it?
Well, I mean, it's always the case that concerns about privacy come in the wake of violations of that privacy, right? So there's a kind of cause and effect relationship. But, you know, it is strange to think about now the way in which we still have a very clear sense of suspicion about big institutions. Again, you know, the National Security Agency collecting data. But yet and still, we're very easily going onto, you know, the Apple website, for instance, and providing all kinds of personal information and letting them customize our music lists and so on. So I think, you know, to find an episode like what Brian described in the beginning, where Target has a better sense of, you know, a family's, you know, growth than, say, you know, the father in that very family. That's the kind of thing that really does help to capture where we are right now.
Nathan Connolly and Brian Ballo, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Nice to speak with you both. Thank you.
Great to be here, Lee.
So you say you're tired of the same old sandwiches. Well, never fear. Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst is here with a reboot because, Kathy, you don't want us to give them up. I mean, these are part of our childhood.
Absolutely. And what your favorite sandwich is says so much about who you are and actually where you grew up. If you told me that your favorite sandwich was a corned beef with Russian and coleslaw, I'd be like, hi, New Yorker. If you said a muffaletta is my favorite sandwich, I'm like, oh, you grew up in New Orleans. And on and on, Italian subs, peanut butter and jelly, egg salad. What your childhood favorite is dear and near. And we're not going to get rid of them. We might up the game a little.
Okay. I'd like to hear about that and like to taste it, especially because they're right next to us.
Oh, you've cleared your plate.
But first, I have not cleared my plate just a little bit. The story goes, though, looking at history, that the sandwich was invented by the Earl of Sandwich, who did not want to leave his card game. So he asked for his roast beef to be slapped between two slices of bread so he could pick it up with his hands. Is that true?
That is the same story that I got. John Montague in the late 1700s was the fourth Earl of Sandwich. But if you go further back, and this is very interesting because we just had the Jewish holiday Passover, the earliest recognizable form of a sandwich may in fact be the Hillel sandwich, which was eaten during Passover. A rabbi living in Jerusalem, this is like 110 BC, suggested eating the bitter herbs inside the matzah bread, and thus the very possibly first sandwich was born.
Amazing. Well, you talk about childhood sandwiches, and you'd asked me, you know, what was my favorite?
I did, and I loved your response. You said, Jewish deli tuna with tomato. Did I say tuna? Did I say tomato?
Did I mention the tomato? Maybe more tomato. And, you know, I would have added preferably on a fishing boat out of Montauk, Long Island, so a little soggy.
Well, you know what? I'll tell you what I did to your tuna sandwich. I decided, how do you up a tuna sandwich? Now, I hope this doesn't freak you out. I got a gorgeous, fresh New England piece of tuna. I marinated it in orange zest and lemon zest and olive oil. I sauteed it, or I would have preferred to grill it. I put it on a beautiful homemade whole grain bread. I made a mayonnaise with lemon and orange zest.
What?
Yeah, so give that a bite and tell me if your childhood suddenly turned turned into 3D.
First of all, I'm taking a picture so I can tweet it. It's amazing. Okay.
You're going to photograph it before you eat it? My goodness. So Robin's was the tuna sandwich. So this is what I call Robin's grown-up tuna. Do you miss the can?
Well,
be honest.
I mean, there's something about leaving a tuna sandwich out in the sun. I know probably health issues on the beach and the
issue of mayo. But we don't have to go there. We have so much else to talk about.
No, but it is delicious. It's absolutely delicious.
There's something about that meaty fresh tuna that's really different.
And the dressing. We'll have it at herenow.org. Amazing. Okay, so
I just tried the other one. This apparently is Jeremy's favorite sandwich, and Jeremy is not in today. Jeremy, I'm sorry, but
little
I'm not
the
saving
weather.
This
yes,
for you.
Yes, you go for it. So Jeremy said grilled ham and cheese is my favorite. So I thought, grilled ham and cheese, what do you do with it? So to up Jeremy's childhood game, I took prosciutto di Parma, the real buttery prosciutto, Genoa salami, olive oil, fresh mozzarella cheese on an Italian bread or French bread. And then I made an olive salad. You can find these sometimes in Italian supermarkets, but I made a homemade one. It's pitted black and green olives with celery, capers, oregano, and I grilled the whole thing till it just melts, sort of like a panini sandwich. It is like the Italian deli at its very best.
Fantastic. Wonderful. I've already tried it even before you came into the room. I have a question, though. There are some onions. I often see grilled onions in sandwiches now. Is this something that you think you should do on your own? It seems pretty easy.
Is it a thing?
I
don't know if it's a thing,
kind of
but
a thing.
Why not? The thing that's important with sandwiches is paying attention to textures and colors, using different breads, mixing it up. When I was a kid, my grandmother, Leona Levy, took me to a ladies' tea house in Midtown Manhattan, one of my fondest memories, and we had chicken salad sandwiches with fresh watercress.
Did they cut the crust off?
Oh, of course.
Yes.
No crust, and I just pretended that I was the most elegant six-year-old. So I upped my game, and the third sandwich on your plate, I made a watercress mayo where I whirled up in a blender or a food processor a head of tender spring watercress with mayonnaise, again, some lemon zest, a lively flavor, and then I mixed it with fresh roasted hunks of chicken. You could use leftover chicken, deli chicken, and I put that on a homemade challah bread. And that brings me back to my childhood, and yet, did it really taste that good? I'm not sure.
This is so terrific. Hey, you know, some quick tips. I mean, you may just want to maybe throw some walnuts and grapes into your chicken salad to boost it. What are just some
sure,
tips?
But beyond that, again, color, texture, try a different bread, a cranberry walnut bread. Suddenly you have texture in your sandwich. I like to pack up sandwiches if I'm leaving first thing in the morning and I'm headed to work or an event where I won't be eating it for several hours. I pack it as two halves. So the SOG factor. SOG factor is your biggest enemy with sandwiches. There are several things you can do. So I pack them up separately, put them together at the last minute, put crisp lettuce leaves on the bread as a protective layer, always experimenting with toppings, olive oil, balsamic instead of mayo, tapenade, anything goes.
We will have it all at herenow.org. Here and Now resident chef Kathy Guns, thank you.
Thank you.
We're ready for lunch. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.